Hello everyone and welcome to Eat Life News, a show dedicated to bringing you all the latest headlines, scoops and narratives going on in the crazy world of Ethereum. I'm your host Dennis Omer, we're joined by my co-host DeFi Dude and Liz from Brighton. This was a week where our attention was jumping all over the place. On one hand, we were keeping an eye out on what's happening with that very important infrastructure bill that impacts crypto in different ways. While on the other hand, we were also having to react to news of the largest hack in DeFi ever. And by hack, I mean people losing a lot of money. And then, of course, we kept getting bombarded with NFT news, NFT projects, new NFT narratives that we're going to dive into as well. And as always, we had news from the DeFi side with more new dApps coming out with all sorts of cool new things. Of course, we're seeing more data that shows that layer twos are growing fast. We saw that EIP-1559 is doing its thing and burning millions of dollars worth of ETH. And the crypto space is as vibrant as ever. So DeFi dude, why don't you kick us off with maybe the largest DeFi hack in history? Like what on earth happened?
Yeah, for sure. So this past week, we did have the largest ever DeFi hack to date. It was kind of crazy. There was over $600 million stolen, I think 611 to be exact. It was stolen from Poly Network, so not the same as Polygon that, you know, we all have talked about and know about. But eventually, you know, a few days later, the hacker ended up returning almost all the money because, well, I'm not sure if this was the exact reason, but apparently he was ID'd by a blockchain security firm. So, you know, you might be wondering, what is Poly Network? How was it hacked? A lot of us, this is the first time we even heard about Poly Network. So Poly Network is a cross-chain protocol. You know, that means it connects multiple blockchains like Ethereum, Polygon, Binance Chain together through a bridge. And that's, you know, where these assets can be sent to back and forth to different chains and all that. So the root of the hack is, it's pretty complex. You've got Kelvin Fitcher. He has a great tweet thread on it if you want to, you know, read more about it, but the block basically summarized it as a cryptography issue where a hacker reversed some private key somewhere and therefore the whole platform was compromised. But I would definitely recommend seeing the tweet thread to really get the, you know, exact reasoning. So over $250 million worth of ETH was stolen, $250 million in BSC or Binance Smart Chain tokens, $85 million worth of USDC on Polygon, and $33 million in Tether. Interestingly, the hacker then did an AMA after the hack by embedding messages in Ethereum transactions. You can sign, you know, messages, put them in, and like you can view them on Etherscan or on-chain. Now, it's kind of interesting because he even mentioned, like, I don't use email. You know, Poly Network was getting emails from the alleged hacker and that kind of thing, but it wasn't him. You know, it's very easy to verify who is him because, you know, he has an on-chain address. So that was really, you know, interesting to see. And in the AMA, on-chain AMA, he said he hacked for fun and because cross-chain hacking is hot and that he always planned on returning the funds. So whether or not he really did plan on returning it, you know, who knows, but that's what he said in the that's what he said in the AMA. He also mentioned he wanted to highlight the bugs on Poly Network and that he couldn't just, you know, politely ask the team to fix it because they might have stolen it themselves.
Yeah, I don't know what to make of like the motives of this crazy hack. Like he's saying he's done it for fun and he always planned on returning the funds. And then he's also saying he wanted to highlight some of the bugs, but he couldn't just ask politely because somehow the team would take advantage of it. Like there's a lot of contradictions going on there. And I think it was just this person saw an opportunity, a weakness. He took it thinking he could get away with it and he didn't get away with it. You know, we've seen this before where chain security companies analysis, like it can be done and it's pretty easy to usually track people back to an IP, or we've seen hacks before. And I think more than half the time there is some kind of evidence left behind that leads pretty close to whoever did this. And it looks like most of the funds, as you said, are being returned back to the Poly Network. I hadn't heard of Poly Network either. I'm kind of surprised they had over 600 million in funds. Interesting. So from there, let's actually talk about the infrastructure bill as well, right? Because last 2 weeks, it's basically been our leading news because, you know, it was a threat to crypto. And what happened is the Senate voted 69-30 to pass the infrastructure bill with the original crypto tax provision in it. So basically, that means none of the amendments that we previously discussed have been included. You know, none of those things that did improve the draconian wording and interpretation has actually been removed. And what we end up with right now is still a bill that treats miners, wallets, and so many other services as brokers, and therefore imposes stringent KYC requirements on them, which is just not workable for this space. That's actually, you know, that's the provision. It's in its original form. And what's sad is that there was actually agreement on the amendments just before the vote. Things like, you know, everyone was in arms about what's going on. People seem to be thinking, okay, how can we improve this? First, they tried to exclude proof of work, and then proof of stake was added to that exemption list and expanded. But at the end of the day, it turned out to be a political football, I guess. I don't know, because what happened is one single senator rejected that amendment. So none of the amendments went through because of one person's objection. And the only reason he objected was, and I kid you not, just because his other amendment, which had nothing to do with crypto, some defense funding amendment, got blocked by Senator Bernie Sanders. So this guy says, oh, if I'm not going to get my amendment, then crypto isn't getting its amendment. And that's how things kind of worked out. Now, of course, there's two kind of parts to how this bill goes through. Now it's passed through the Senate, and from there it moves on to the House. So now there has to be another vote. And the House is currently on holidays, and they're coming back September 20th, and that's the earliest it'll be voted on. Now, we're not sure if amendments can be made. We've been, you know, tracking Jake Chervinsky, who has great kind of threads on this, and he's just saying, like, we're not sure if amendments can be passed before it goes to the House vote. It's quite a mess. And the thing is, this crypto is just one small part of this huge infrastructure bill, which has so many other different conflicting interests beyond crypto, just normal politics. And you had some moderate Democrats say that they won't even vote on budget resolutions that are kind of needed to pass a separate $3.5 trillion social policy package unless this infrastructure bill is passed in a certain way. I mean, there's a lot of horse trading going on. It's a bit of a mess, but it is going to take time to play out. So we're going to keep an eye out on that. So coming back to DeFi, we had a bit more drama, right? We had two different, basically, projects come head to head.
Yeah, we did. We actually saw Sushi and Optimism kind of butt heads this last week. You know, we've mentioned before that Optimism, the optimistic roll-up flavored layer two solution, is having a gated launch. So that means they're boarding projects almost one by one just to ensure everything goes smooth on the new layer two. You know, they've got a whitelist, so not everyone can just launch whenever they want. So transactions per second are already limited, and they're taking, you know, just a very cautious approach. And so Uniswap, they've always kind of been big proponents of Optimism for years now. You had like the Unipig exchange, you know, proof of concept, and, you know, they'll be one of the first dApps to launch on Optimism. But this is actually the reason for the drama. So you have Joseph DeLong from the Sushi team. He actually tweeted that they're not going to deploy on Optimism. At a bare minimum, they're at least going to wait and see, and then possibly, you know, use a credibly neutral platform like Arbitrum after all this kind of drama, so we can kind of dive in, you know, what exactly happened there. So basically, you know, SushiSwap, they said that they're ready to deploy on Optimism after preparing on Coven testnet, but the Optimism team has basically told them that Uniswap had to go first. So the Optimism team got criticism, you know, that they're basically picking winners. Maybe VCs influenced their decisions, things like that. And Optimism shot back saying, no, that's not the case at all. Uniswap started working on integrating Optimism way before SushiSwap even existed, and that they're applying first in, first out. You know, I kind of get where both sides are coming from, but Joseph actually, he made a good analogy, and he was basically like, if I go to a grocery store and I know what I want, I get two items, I go to the checkout, you know, I don't want to sit around and wait for the customer that entered the store before me to finish shopping if I'm already ready to check out. So I think that was, you know, a good analogy, and I kind of explained it pretty well.
Yeah. Although, I mean, Okay, I saw that analogy as well, and I'm thinking, well, that's a grocery store, and that's completely different than trying to have a kind of cautious, planned, methodical launch of a layer two platform, which everyone's going to have a chance to deploy on at some point anyway. And I mean, I understand both sides, actually. I understand SushiSwap's frustrations. They're ready to deploy. They want to go and access the users on Optimism from day one. And, you know, why shouldn't they if it's possible? But then I also understand Optimism, who are following some kind of process and are saying, well, this is how we want to proceed through these different steps. There's been different, different teams have kind of invested time and money into getting this deployment right. And they just want to follow that. And they're saying it's going to open up to SushiSwap at some point anyway. So I'm not over, I can understand Optimism as well. Let's see. I mean, at some point it's going to be open anyway. And related to Optimism, we have another optimistic kind of roll-up, and that's Arbitrum, who announced this week that they're actually going to open up to users in August. So you guys might remember we mentioned it before, where hundreds of projects had already been given access to mainnet, and dozens of them have actually successfully completed the deployment, and the only thing was left now was for users to be able to access it. And now they can do so in August. Now, the team will be rolling out Arbitrum 1, which is a portal where users have a quick and easy way to access like every dApp and every service provider on Arbitrum. And okay, we don't have an exact date yet, but there's basically half of August left. So we have another, in the worst case, 15 days to kind of get our hands onto Arbitrum and finally start using it. Of course, we also have to mention that it is in beta. So the team have mentioned that they will continue to maintain those upgradability controls, and those kind of controls let them respond to any security incidents and kind of unexpected behavior they can step in. So just have that in mind when you're transferring assets there. This is still super early days, and it was good to see the team are taking a cautious approach, and they've put some initial limits on the volume of activity as well, but these will be gradually increased over time. So yeah, we're really excited about this. Now, DeFi dude, I saw you tweeted something about Jack living rent-free in all our heads, in our minds. And I guess that's kind of true, right? Because we've brought him up many times in this podcast before. But I think now we actually have something kind of tangential to that. And maybe you can go into what's happening with social media and blockchains.
Yeah, definitely. As much as a lot of us dislike, I guess, a lot of what Jack does, we definitely still do talk about him quite a lot, especially this week. You know, there's a lot of debate around social media platforms and kind of transparency, openness, you know, decentralization. And a lot of crypto discussion actually takes place on Twitter, for example. But Twitter does have its downsides. So first, you know, it's owned and run, obviously, by Jack Dorsey, the toxic Bitcoin maximalist that we all know. He's got this notion in his head kind of that Ethereum is a scam because it had a presale back in 2015 and is therefore not decentralized, and therefore it must be a scam because there was a presale. And we've brought this up a number of times previously, and we don't really want to dwell on that, but it does mean that decisions, you know, can be very arbitrary when it comes to Twitter and Jack. Like, you know, Bitcoin can have its own emoji, Ethereum can't. Of course, maybe someone could pay for it, I'm not sure, but policies and guidelines, they're just not transparent. You know, no one knows the process for getting verified, meaning people get scammed from crypto scams and all sorts of stuff a lot more than they should. And a few weeks ago, we actually mentioned that Stani, the founder of Aave, had teased that they're building a decentralized social media platform. So a lot of people almost thought this was a joke at first, that they weren't serious, but they are definitely serious. So, you know, it's really awesome to see. And so now we have a bit more information on this, actually. Stani teased that every account on Aave's social media protocol will be able to bring their Ethereum wallets and their own audience to the platform. Tokenization by default, no social tokens. It's still cryptic. You know, we still don't know everything about it. But the ideas have a lot of potential, and obviously the people behind it, Aave, you know, they're very pro decentralization and that kind of stuff. So it's not going to be limited by, you know, a Bitcoin maximalist such as Jack. So it'll be really cool to see where they go with that.
Yeah, I'm dying to find out what they're building. It sounds like whatever it is, it's going to be super innovative. Well, something new, something that hasn't been tried. So let's see how that plays out. And we should probably also notice that Aave have mentioned that they're looking to expand beyond Ethereum and Polygon, and they're kind of embracing this multi-chain strategy. So Stanley was speaking at the Chainlink Smart Contract Summit last week, and he said that they were exploring lending and borrowing on Solana, on Avalanche, on Arbitrum, on Optimism. So basically the way they're thinking about it is that if it has EVM compatibility, that kind of makes life so much easier that that EVM compatibility is an important factor that will influence where they expand to. This week, we also had some news from Zapper, right? What's happening there?
Yeah, Zapper, you know, the super popular dashboard, we've covered it quite a few times, I think, on previous podcasts. It is, you know, a DeFi service. They actually announced a few days ago that they were going back on their decision to charge 0.4 fee for zapping in and out of positions. So they got a lot of, you know, criticism for introducing this fee. Although a lot of the criticism, I believe, was more around like their communication and how they just suddenly introduced the fee rather than, you know, communicate it properly for what a lot of people thought would be the right thing to do. So Zapper published a blog post just a few days ago going over this whole kerfuffle. They said it was important to be able to have a product, you know, that can live on its own without external funding, like by monetizing. And secondly, that their users felt that since Zapper doesn't charge for the product, the users must be the product, which, you know, is not a good thing, I'd say. So they clarified that this is definitely not the case. They do not and will never sell user data, which that when we say the user must be the product, that's kind of what we mean. Your data being stored, sold, whatever. So it's good that they did clarify that.
I completely understand that they're between a rock and a hard place, because at the end of the day, they do kind of have to monetize. I mean, you can't just live off VC money forever. I mean, it has to be an organic, self-sustaining business as well, right? So, and another thing to consider is MetaMask charges 0.88%, which is incredibly high, but there's so many people that do accept using that. Maybe they're not aware of it. I don't know what, but they were making at some point, I think, $200,000 in daily revenue just from that swap fee. So Zapper came in with 0.4%. Maybe it's too high. I'm not sure. It depends on, you know, Zapper's own research. I'm guessing they did go back and they did get feedback before setting on 0.4%, right? So yeah, now they've walked it completely back, but I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing to charge a very small amount. Maybe it didn't have to be 0.4, maybe it could be less, but DeFi dApps do have to explore viable business models, and this is just one more avenue. So let's see how Zapper do in the future as well. Now, another product that we wanted to highlight this week was Gearbox. So Gearbox is a generalized leverage platform. So they basically allow you to take out leverage in one place and use it across various different protocols and platforms in a very composable way. So what they're saying is, for example, you can leverage farm on Yearn, or you can margin trade on Uniswap or SushiSwap, or you can even arbitrage pegged assets on Curve and more. And what their core vision is to become, in the back end, a very composable, leverage-focused protocol, which, you know, users don't need to interact with directly. It's all done. That's just a protocol in the back end. And how they're able to do it is they can create these leverage positions by kind of binding together lenders and borrowers into this concept called credit accounts. And a credit account is basically an isolated smart contract which holds the user's funds plus borrowed funds. And it has this kind of liquidation threshold. And it also has a list of approved tokens and protocols. So these funds on credit accounts are then used as collateral for debt on multiple different platforms. It's a pretty cool concept, although it does need a bit of reading to really understand and absorb the concept. So yeah, we definitely recommend checking it out on gearbox.fi or follow them on Twitter or at Gearbox Protocol. It's a pretty cool and new kind of DeFi primitive.
Yeah, we've also got some news from Dune Analytics this week. They announced that they led an $8 million Series A round led by Union Square Ventures. So if you don't know what Dune Analytics is, it's a very popular crypto analytics platform. where anyone can go and run scripts and extract on-chain information. You know, these scripts can be turned into dashboards, and there's already more than 1,000 dashboards. It's really custom. You can really do a lot with it. So like you could have a DeFi dashboard that aggregates, you know, various DeFi metrics like TVL, users, number of transactions, all into one screen. Super easy to use and to read. Really awesome. Their mission is basically to make crypto data accessible to everyone, and they've accomplished a lot of growth in the past 3 years. So that's cool to see. Their investors also include Redpoint Ventures, Dragonfly Capital, and Multicoin Capital. You know, we wish them all the best in the next stage just of their growth story, because we've seen it, you know, firsthand, so much growth and everything they've accomplished over the past couple of years. So that's awesome to see. And they are hiring engineers as well, on a side note. So if you're an engineer looking for work in crypto, awesome place to be.
Yeah, I actually met Frederick and Mats, the co-founders, 3 years ago at East Berlin when they were just starting off. And they're such cool guys, and they were so passionate about what they're building, and they really believed that their product would bring value to the space. And it's so exciting to see that they've actually executed on that vision. Like, June Analytics is such a useful and powerful tool, and I think this kind of raise kind of validates that what they're building does provide a service to all of crypto and to so many different kinds of people. From there, we move on to a scoop that Frank Shapiro, who's the director of news at the Block, kind of tweeted out. And his scoop is that demand for ETH from institutions has surged and is pushing these big players like Fidelity and the NYDIG to expand their crypto offerings, even though they kind of started as, BTC only. So he's actually, in his tweet, pointed out that data from Coinbase and FalconX suggest that interest in ETH has picked up over the last quarter, and volumes on Coinbase have even topped Bitcoin. Even on FalconX, which is a digital asset trading platform, which, like, just on a side note, they just raised $210 million at a $3.75 billion valuation, which kind of shows just how much they've grown. Their data shows that ETH volumes have increased by 10%, whereas BTC volume has actually decreased by 12% in the last quarter. So that's incredibly bullish news for ETH kind of increasing its base and being used more and more.
Yeah, we did see, I think just a couple of months ago, we started to see Ethereum use more fees on cryptofees.info. It shows like which chains are using the most fees, and that topped Bitcoin long ago. And so now to see trading volume on like Coinbase and FalconX go above Bitcoin, meanwhile Bitcoin's decreasing, like that's pretty interesting to see. Yeah, really cool. So in NFT news this week, we do have another generative NFT project that kind of took Twitter by storm. It is known as the Pudgy Penguins, or Pengs, or Pengus, whatever you want to call it. I've seen it all being named. So for those of you that may not know, PFP, which is, you know, being commonly kind of used for these projects, this is an acronym for profile picture. Even though profile picture is two words, I don't know. People are calling them, you know, PFP, NFTs, that kind of stuff. Just means, you know, profile picture. So Pudgy Penguins, you know, as they're called, blew up last week very quickly on Twitter, which also kind of brought some concern, or, you know, criticism, I guess, from users that are suggesting that maybe it's engineered or like coordinated, you know, whether it's influencers or a group of people coordinating the hype. That's kind of what the criticism, you know, was. And, you know, while it's kind of impossible to really know if it was coordinated from the start, it's become quite obvious that at this point, it's just kind of blown up so much that any coordination that might have been, you know, the case early on is just long gone, because the community has caught on to the penguins. They aped in, you know, as the community does, and it just blew up. So whether or not it was coordinated from the start, I don't know if we will ever know that answer. But at this point, I think it's safe to say that any coordination is long gone. So, you know, five people coordinated to hype them up at this point, there's hundreds and hundreds of people supporting the penguins. So yeah, I don't think it's a factor anymore.
Yeah, I saw some tweets. I think it's called Sweeping or something. I'm not saying like this is for the penguins, but other ones tried, where someone goes around buying all the lowest priced NFTs for that project, for example. And that just raises the price, and then they just go and resell it as soon as the price has peaked, or I guess it does happen, right? But then again, I don't know, you keep seeing so many different NFT projects come out and the prices of these things are ridiculous. So even you even have like rock NFTs that cost hundreds of thousands of dollars, and it just feels like insanity sometimes, but many people are convinced this is the future. So let's see how the price plays out. That's what I'm really curious about. I think we know that NFTs are here, they're never going away, but I'm just curious if the price goes through a big crash at some point or not.
Yeah, for sure. Definitely something to just keep an eye on, those floor prices and all that stuff, see where they go. In non-generative NFT news, we do have some rarible news. So rarible, it's kind of a, sort of like OpenSea. I might get in trouble for saying that, but you know, it allows artists to bring their art or make art and release it on Rarible, kind of just a platform for that. And they actually announced Rarible Protocol last week. So they define Rarible Protocol as a set of tools to simplify the go-to market process for NFT projects and ideas. The new protocol brings some key features that weren't previously available, notably a decentralized exchange with fee splitting capability. So when we say decentralized exchange, we don't mean buying NFTs on Uniswap, but just the act of buying NFTs in a trustless manner. And that kind of, you know, with the fee splitting, it opens possibilities like co-creating NFTs and, you know, splitting the fees, revenue. Another key feature is shared order book and liquidity, as well as lazy minting of ERC 721s and 1155. So that the lazy minting enables anyone, regardless of their knowledge in crypto, to easily mint an NFT without paying any transaction fee up front. Instead, the gas costs associated with minting are paid off to the buyer when the NFT is sold. So buyer would pay that gas fee or whatever fee it is to mint it. Another key feature is the royalties standard. So, you know, as you may know on OpenSea and some other platforms, there is a royalty that can go like to the artist when it's sold. And even if, you know, the artist isn't selling it, but someone else is selling the original artist's work, there can still be royalties that get pushed back to the artist. So this standard enables royalties regardless where the NFT is sold. So for example, anything sold on OpenSea from Super Rare right now, they don't get any royalties as they should. So that's kind of what this aims to solve. And then finally, an open source indexer, which allows developers to kind of index NFTs and just get a ton of useful information like metadata, orders, activity, ranking, etc. And the very first open source indexer in this case is actually Rarible Protocol, as they've stated. And then lastly, in NFT news, and again, I feel like every week I'm saying this, but there is literally so much going on right now in NFTs that we could probably go on for, you know, another hour. Meme turns one today. So Don't Buy Meme or Meme, basically it spawned out of a Telegram chat late one night after a joke by ex-consensus Jordan Lyle. He, you know, within 24 hours, the Telegram spawned a token, built the community, and basically, since that day, Meme has become a platform, kind of the first of its kind, that allowed users to stake the native ERC-20 to accrue pineapple points or reward points, which in turn let them purchase various NFTs from their favorite artists. So, you know, it's crazy that's already been a year. Looking forward, you know, to see what comes next. I do like the idea of, like, instead of just having to pay $10,000 up front or these crazy valuations for NFTs, the idea that you can stake a token, you know, accrue rewards, and then purchase NFTs that you like. You don't have to, you know, fork up cash up front. You know, you're basically farming these rewards, which are rewards only for NFTs. So that's cool. Will be cool to see, you know, what they do over the next year as well.
Kind of crazy that it feels like it happened like years ago. When they say like 1 year in crypto is like, what, 5-10 years in the normal world. And imagine everything that's happened since Meme first came out, right? It feels like almost a completely different landscape. But it was just a year ago that we were like, you know, having these fun NFTs that were approaching things slightly differently. But it's crazy how far we've come. And yeah, happy first birthday. Like, imagine having a first birthday, like, makes Meme an OG in the NFT world. All right. So yeah. And lastly, it's been just over a week since EIP 1559 was introduced. So where do we stand right now? Well, first of all, the number of ETH burnt since launch is now at around 42,000 ETH, which at today's prices is $140 million worth of ETH, which I think is a bit higher than many of us were expecting when this first launched. I mean, just because of that, the ETH issuance rate, also, you know, you can think of it as inflation, has actually been reduced by 34%. Now, when it's merged with ETH2, that's going to dramatically decrease, and I think it's going to be negative inflation as well. But, you know, the burn has already started, and that's been going very impressively. And then we also saw that the adoption of clients who do implement EIP-1559 has jumped from 5%, like on the first day, to around 20%. And this is only going to increase because some big wallets like MetaMask haven't moved over yet to that EIP-1559 transaction format. And once they do, that even more clients are going to be using the EIP-1559 transaction format, so even more ETH will be burnt. And then I also actually saw a tweet from Block Native, who published some data and some charts, and that was in line with Nansen's conclusion, which the numbers above that we just shared were from Nansen. So Block Native's charts are kind of similar, and the conclusions are that, you know, traction for EIP-1559 is steadily increasing, and that's a good thing. These things take time to be completely adopted. So all in all is looking good in the land of Ethereum. Of course, we did have a crazy hack, but thank God the money was returned. And on that note, we wrap up what's been another action-packed week. As always, thank you for joining us on this journey. We're all going to make it. And until we catch you next time, bye-bye.
Thanks, guys.
This podcast is supported by the awesome team at Kyber Network. For more information and to find out how Kyber Network provides liquidity to over 100 different dApps, wallets, and exchanges, check out kyber.network.